So we've been following this seven-point mind training text from Geshe Chikawa. This mind training, or Lojong system of practice, of course, was brought into Tibet through Lama Atisha, passing it down from master to disciple. And then when it came down to Geshe Chikawa, he arranged all of these slogans, I think 57 slogans in all, into these seven sections called the 7 points. And the commentary we're using, of course, is a commentary by Sechubu Chögyi Gelson, one of his main disciples, which is just basically notes from talks that Geshe Chikawa gave. So it's more or less a commentary by Geshe Chikawa himself. And in these 7 points, the first point, of course, was the preliminaries, the foundation practices necessary as a basis for the main practice. Second point was the main practice, the two bodhicittas, conventional bodhicitta, ultimate bodhicitta. Ultimate bodhicitta, of course, the wisdom of emptiness practice. Conventional bodhicitta, using this approach of exchanging self with others to cultivate bodhicitta. And then the third of the 7 points was taking these adverse conditions into the path. So this is another one of the great strengths with the mind training or Lojong system of practice, the ability to take even adverse conditions into the path, to be able to use adverse conditions to not see them as problems or obstacles, but as opportunities. And we can take them into the path through both the wisdom wing and the compassion wing of practice. So in the compassion wing of practice, we saw there that to be able to take adverse conditions into the path, we need to correctly distinguish between friend and enemy. That the real enemy is the self-cherishing and others are our friends, even those who harm us. And if we can see this, then we can take adverse conditions into the path to help. And so we can see the perpetrators of harm are actually benefiting us in many ways. And so we can take those harmful conditions and also suffering into the path using the compassion wing of practice. And also we can use the wisdom wing to take adverse conditions into the path as well, to do this illusory-like emptiness practice. And then we had a look earlier today, this morning, about the fourth point, the presentation of a lifetime's practice in summary, i.e. what is the essence of all of the Lojong or mind training practices. And we saw here that the essence are these five powers. And we can apply these five powers in daily life and at the time of death as the essence of all of these Lojong practices. And so we saw there that in daily life, the first of the five powers, propelling intention, was to set the intention to practice the two bodhicittas throughout the day, the week, the month, the year, the rest of our life, to set that intention. And we can really do that certainly every morning, to set the intention to practice wisdom and compassion, the ultimate conventional bodhicitta, throughout the day. And then, of course, the second power, the power of acquaintance, is then throughout the day to uninterruptedly practice wisdom and compassion in meditation and integrating into daily life. And the third power, the power of positive seed, to support that is just to engage in virtuous activities to increase the merit, so we can have that positive energy, that positive merit as a basis for being able to practice. And then together with that, the fourth one was this eradication, to really eradicate whenever we notice self-grasping, particularly self-cherishing arising through the day, to really eradicate and let go of that self-grasping and self-cherishing attitude. And then the fifth one was the aspirational prayer. And this is in the form of dedication, to dedicate everything we've done through the day and to make that aspiration to continue to never be separated from the two bodhicittas, and also to make aspirations to meet qualified teachers who can help us in that practice. So that's how to use these five powers in daily life. And then we saw we can also use the same five powers at the time of death in a slightly different way, some of them. The first one here was the power of positive seed, which was really a lot to do about letting go of attachments, so that we can go through the death process without all this craving and attachment to possessions, friends, and body. The aspirational prayer, again, to aspire to never be separated from wisdom and compassion, the two bodhicittas, to meet teachers. And then eradication is, as we're going through the death process, to let go of self-cherishing and self-grasping. And then the propelling intention is to set that intention to practice wisdom and compassion throughout the death process, through the intermediate state and into the next life. And then, of course, acquaintance is actually, as we're going through the death process, then to uninterruptedly practice the wisdom and compassion. In terms of what we saw in the text is really to practice the Tonglen, and then to alternate that with resting in the expanse of the mind, in resting in the awareness, in terms of resting in the experience of emptiness, and to sort of alternate these practices. So that was the fourth point. So that moves us on now to the fifth point of the 7 points, and that is the measure of having trained the mind. Because as with any practice, if it'd be good to be able to somehow measure whether we are making any progress, to how can we measure actually if our practice is going in the right direction and we're actually making progress. So here we have, I think, 4 slogans that can help us to measure whether or not our mind training practice is going in the right direction and is going well. So let's have a look at those slogans. So now we're on page 15 on the right-hand side near the bottom. It says here, the intent of all teachings converges on a single point. So let's have a look at the commentary here. Actually, before we go to that, let's give a little introduction into this fifth point in general, reading from this book here, The Practice of Lojong, what he says about this fifth point of the measure of having trained the mind. So this is on page 147. We may want to assess our mind training practice from time to time in order to evaluate our progress. The 4 slogans contained in this point are dedicated to measuring our progress on the path by establishing whether our minds are becoming more other-centered or whether they are simply mired in more subtle habitual perceptions of the world. We need a balanced approach to this Lojong point, because an obsessive concern over our progress is just another form of fixation, while failing to attend to it at all is equally detrimental. Committing these sayings to memory will make them a self-regulatory aspect of our practice. Each of these slogans is a pithy, succinct, often enigmatic saying that reveals its depth through repeated contemplation. They are known as the 4 methods of appraisal for evaluating our ability to exchange self for others on the Lojong path. So let's have a look at these 4 slogans. So again here, the first one, the intent of all teachings converge on a single point. Let's see the commentary on that. The scriptures and treatises were taught for the purpose of overcoming self-grasping. Thus there is no target other than this for the trio of study, reflection and meditation to destroy. So we saw that there were those, right at the beginning of this course, we talked about these 3 types of wisdom, of hearing, contemplation and meditation. So here they are, study, reflection, meditation. When examined, the selfhood of persons is as non-existent as the horn of a rabbit. So this is obviously often an analogy given for the level of existence of a self, this horn on a rabbit. So of course, rabbits don't have horns. So often we talk about the self of person is just like the horn of a rabbit. It's completely non-existent. Nevertheless, it has made us suffer since beginningless time. So again, as I mentioned earlier, it's quite crazy to think that the root of all of our suffering is a non-existent, something that doesn't exist, never has existed, doesn't exist, cannot exist. But of course, we believe that it exists, and that's why we suffer. Observe and analyze whether all your endeavors of body, speech, and mind are directed toward reinforcing your grasping at the selfhood of persons or bringing its downfall. If they are reinforcing it, you are striving solely out of the eight mundane concerns. So that was the eight worldly concerns that we looked at the other day. Gain and loss, pleasure and pain, praise and blame, good and bad reputation. And for the pursuit of greatness in this life. If this is the case, then even if you are observing ethical discipline with dedication, you have erred with regard to your paternal spiritual lineage. Even if you are training the mind through study, reflection, and meditation, the practice has gone awry. On the other hand, if your endeavors are toppling self-grasping, you are achieving the true purpose of ethical discipline with industry, and you are training the mind with skillfulness. In this way, by giving rise to genuine mind-training realizations in your mind, you can likewise attain the full measure of Dharma practice. Since this is the benchmark for determining whether a Dharma practice has truly become a Dharma practice, the master said, this is the long bar of a scale on which the practitioner is weighed. Learn how to turn all your endeavors of body, speech, and mind into antidotes to self-grasping. So just a little comment here from Alan Wallace again about this point, what he says. This is on page 242 of his book. 232, sorry. The central theme of this mind training is to direct our entire practice to the elimination of self-grasping. When we examine all our physical, verbal, and mental activities, if we find our sense of ego is inflated by our spiritual practice, then our efforts have been subverted in the pursuit of the eight mundane concerns. And this is going to come up in a couple of slogans later, which we're going to look at tomorrow, is that it's very easy for our whole spiritual practice to be hijacked by the ego. Because here, as we see in this point, the whole purpose of everything we do in practice is to eliminate self-grasping. Another way of saying that is to eliminate the ego. And so, of course, the ego doesn't want to die. So, therefore, the ego is going to fight back. And it's very often the case that the ego sneaks up on us. And then before we know it, our whole Dharma practice is being corrupted by the ego. And now we've become a spiritual ego. That we're doing our practice for gain, fame, and so forth. And so then, you know, that we become a spiritual ego. And unfortunately, we see this even here in India. You know, often people who sort of come into this sort of spiritual practice, then they often, you know, they put on this sort of really funky Buddhist clothing and wear all this Buddhist paraphernalia. Often they're shaving their head and they're walking around and looking very spiritual and telling everyone, of course, how spiritual they are. You know, so this is just spiritual materialism. It's a very nice book from Chogyam Trungpa called Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism. And it's really, we can laugh, but I know from experience and seeing many people, it can really sneak up on us. Even if we go into practice with a very humble intention to really not make it into an ego trip, it's very easy to go that way. And before you know it, the ego's got hold, and now we're just a spiritual ego. So, you know, we can laugh about it, but it's very tricky. You know, we have to really be careful about that. Otherwise, our whole spiritual practice will go astray. And then we'll just become, instead of grasping at other things, we're just going to grasp at our spiritual practice, and we're going to be a spiritual ego. And to be honest, often the spiritual ego is one of the worst. Because it has this air of superiority, you know. I'm better than you. I'm spiritual. Are you spiritual? No. See? So, very careful.
Like someone that changed his name to Siddhartha. Hmm? Oh my goodness.
Someone that I met changed his name to Siddhartha.
Yeah, I mean, we saw that earlier in the text, this idea of ordination name. I mean, if we do it in a good way, it can be helpful, because if we can change our name and then associate with that name sort of Dharma practice and remind ourselves of Dharma practice is fine. But again, you know, and of course, often the case is when these things, you know, we're just putting on some spiritual clothing, you know, and boosting the ego. And so that's what's saying here is that, you know, let's check and see whether the ego is getting boosted or is getting cut. If it's getting boosted, our whole practice has gone astray.
So the more you practice, the worse it becomes, yeah? You get bigger. Now it is small, with practice it becomes...
It could do if we don't do this. If we don't keep a check, if we allow the 8 mundane concerns to sneak in, it can. I mean, same with everything, of course. And that's why this point is here, to highlight to us the whole purpose of our training is to cut the ego, to use another word than self-grasping, self-cherishing. And these slogans, and also the next one is going to be helpful for this as well.
But you can't really check on yourself because you are in yourself, so how to get a check up if you...
The next point is going to help.
Yeah.
Next point is going to help on this. But again, understanding that, you know, and these are actually what these points are, and the next one also is going to help on this. But again, you know, how to check is exactly this point. Is our self-cherishing, self-grasping reducing or not? Is it reducing or not? You know, are we becoming a more kind and compassionate person? One thing that I think is very helpful is, what is our perspective when we, in any situation, have we got just a first person perspective? First person perspective is we view every situation from my perspective. How is this situation affecting me? If we have that perspective usually, then self-cherishing is there. A lot, probably. If we're reducing self-cherishing and cherishing others more, of course we're going to have immediately second-person perspective. So one of the things that we can see if this is working is when we encounter someone, are we immediately trying to see the situation from their perspective or not? Or we couldn't care less what they think. We're just my perspective. Then there's self-cherishing. Even better, third-person perspective, is if we come into a situation and see the situation from the bigger view, like as a third person seeing both ourselves and others, even better. But at least second-person perspective. So if we find that we're always going into situations simply on the perspective, how is this going to affect me? Then self-cherishing and spiritual ego, big time, big time, big time. And another thing is very helpful here, and it's something that I also do a lot, is, and I think I brought this up earlier, that this medical study, that people who use the word I, me and mine a lot have a 30% greater risk of heart attack. Check. And I do this a lot. Is particularly if you're writing like an email, check how many times the word I, me and mine is in the email. Check. I had a friend once.
What's too much in the...
I had a friend once who had a lot of problems, and they wrote me a very long email, and I highlighted I, me, and my, and it was it was completely full. So it was like self-obsession. Yes, you got problems, but instead of describing the problem, you describe I have this problem. I. It's all me. This is something I check a lot. I mean, even when you're speaking. And you're speaking about some situation, How often do you talk about the situation, or how often do you say, I did this, I? Check. Check.
How can you tell what's too much and what's normal?
Again, just look.
Okay.
Just look.
It doesn't matter if I say, for instance, I'm a good person or I'm a bad person, I experience guilt or shame, it doesn't matter. Everything is the same, yeah?
No, but it's, again, what I'm saying here is that often when we're writing an email or something, we're describing a situation. But you can describe the situation from the perspective of the situation, or you can describe it from my perspective. This is the difference. And I check this all the time, and I find myself also putting a lot of I, me, my, and then I stop and I rewrite the sentence. Like, instead of I did this, I say this happened today, blah, 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 blah. Talk about the event rather than the agent. And it's very helpful. It's very helpful.
Oh my goodness.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
It becomes like a report.
So this is a way of checking. Just check how much these words, I, me, and my, come in your letters and emails and messages. Check.
There is one very famous saying of Buddha. Events happen, deeds are done, but there is no individual doer thereof. Like this.
Mahayana wouldn't agree with that. Yeah. That's not correct. There's no independent agent, but there's an agent. This is a little bit the Vaibhashika Sautrantika view.
I had a question about this guru stuff. Some of the time I'm in India, I'm staying in Rishikesh. And in Rishikesh, you have like all of this, you know, culture of gurus and stuff like this. You know, Muji, there is this Prim Baba,
sure.
And all of those.
Sure.
And also, I've been to Amma's ashram. Hmm. And I don't, you know, I have some friends who really like, they were, oh, Muji and Prim Baba. And every time, you know, I don't know how to react to that, you know, because for me, this is like devotion that for me is not, what is, I don't know how to, you know, respond.
Yeah.
How do you say, what do you say?
Because
for them it's so important, you know.
Yeah. Again, talk about the teachings, talk about the qualities, or don't talk about the person. In fact, there's these four reliances in Buddhism. Don't rely on the teacher, rely on the teaching. Don't rely on the words, rely on the meaning. Don't just rely on the intellectual meaning, on the experience. And don't rely on just the experience on direct realization. So there's these four reliances. So, you know, if someone's going to these people, and I'm sure some of these people have some very good qualities and good messages, talk about the messages, not the person. Because that's just worship. And that's what people do, often, unfortunately, because it makes them somehow feel good. But, of course, I've heard some stories about some of these events where people are, like, pushing and shoving, get out of my way. And also here at the temple with Dalai Lama, that's my seat, get out of my way, you know. Come on. Okay. Yeah.
I have a question. Is this spiritual materialism when, since a few months, when people tell me their problems and they don't ask, can you help me or what do you think? And I immediately start to, Buddhism would say, and why don't you try this? And
no. I mean, again, it's all to do with motivation. If your motivation is, I've got something to tell you, just listen to me, you know. Then that's spiritual materialism. But if from a genuine motivation of compassion, you know, particularly if the advice is not like, I think you should do this, but rather from a Buddhist perspective, this is helpful. So again, it checked the motivation. This is what's saying here, check. If you really have a genuine motivation of compassion, then fine. And of course, you need wisdom with that, which means if the person is open and asking, and then give them some advice. But don't push the advice onto them. You know, often what we do is we see someone suffering in a certain way, and we may think we have some very good advice for them, but then we push it onto them. And then, of course, we have the opposite effect. Because we know from our own experience, if someone tries to push something onto us, even if it's the best thing for us, we usually reject it. We go, back off, who are you to tell me what to do? And even if it's the right, best advice for us, we'll reject it. So therefore, we need that wisdom. So again, check the motivation, you know. And often, and this is something here as well, this comes up in one of the slogans very shortly tomorrow morning, is when we're doing this, better to do it in private. Because if we do it in public, again, it's a show, you know. Look, I'm just giving all this advice here. You know? So do it in private, quietly. Don't make a big show of it. And again, check the motivation. If the motivation is healthy, is good, that we're really doing it for their benefit and not just to show off, because this is the eight worldly concerns, is, you know, good reputation, praise, showing off, then, you know, better not if it's just to show off.
But is it better to say nothing when they don't ask for?
Even then, you'll find in the text, it'll say even if they don't ask, but you see that they're open and it could help, then even then. But again, that's where wisdom comes in.
Yeah.
If we see that they're not very open and that trying to give it, they'll reject, then we wouldn't say anything. But if we see that the type of person that they're very open, they've obviously got some problems and we believe that we have something that can help, then in a very gentle, kind way, say that. Again, don't push. But again, this is where wisdom comes in, to know whether or not to offer that advice or say nothing. Because if they're very closed and fixed, trying to say something will have the opposite effect. You basically close the door on your ability to help them in the future, because they'll go, well, I'm not going to listen to that person, they're trying to push stuff onto me. Whereas if you say nothing and then you're just around them and you're actually leading by example, trying to be a better person, after some time they'll say, wow, look, this person's really got their act together. Maybe they've got something to help me. And then from their side, they'll ask. So that's how we can help people who are very closed-minded, is simply lead by example. And that's one of the things we find in Buddhism often, is to lead by example. And so lead by example, and then they'll see. And then they may ask if they're not open. So this is how we can do. Chogyam Trungpa. Trungpa. T-R-U-N-G-P-A. Chogyam. C-H-O-G-Y-A-M, I think. Something like that. And Trungpa. T-R-U-N-G-P-A.
Tibetan?
Yeah.
I'm writing, and I use the first person's perspective to give the reader a feel of being involved, like being inside.
Yeah, but see, the thing is, there's ways we can do that. Yeah. We can write about the event where it's obvious that we are the ones who are the agent without using I, me, me, I. So try this.
Yeah, I
mean, we're not talking about... Sometimes people take this to the extreme and they just cut out those words, and then, of course, it doesn't make any sense. You know. No, but what I'd suggest is next time you write something like that, go back and have a look and see if you can restructure it, still making sense and obvious to the reader, and cut down the number of words of I, me, my.
Okay.
Check it. Yeah. I do that all the time.
It's a good challenge.
And it's very helpful. It's very helpful. Very helpful, because it gets us out of this first-person perspective. Because also when we hear something from someone and they're constantly saying, I, in the end we go, come on, you know, that's enough. Give it a break, you know, don't we? We don't like it when other people just talking about themselves all the time.
If they get interesting stories to...
But then you tell the story instead of the center of the focus is the story and not the person.
It's very good.
Yeah. Try it. Very interesting.
If I send flowers, I can say I love you or love you.
No, you can say wishing you love or wishing you all the best. No? Can't you? You can say instead of I love you, wishing you all love and happiness or something. No? It's still obvious, but we're cutting out the me. It's more about the love for the person.
I ask because I had the birthday and my husband said, brought flowers and he wrote love you. I asked, who loved me?
It's way more beautiful to say love you than I stylistically spoken.
Sorry.
It's beautiful love you than other people.
Yeah.
Although there is like, you know, a lot of things that being said of like to say to someone, I love you, it's very hard also, you know, in a way in our culture.
Okay, let's go on here in the text.
In a way.
Okay, we covered this section, yeah. Okay, so let's go on to the next point then. Of the two witnesses, uphold the principal one. So let's read a little bit first from Alan Wallace, what he says. Well, actually, let's read the text here first, and then we'll go to Alan Wallace. People might say of you, this brother's heart has become softened like a piece of wool that is taken out of water after being washed. Genuine spiritual practice has arisen in him. True Dharma practitioner refers to all who are like him. Not being disapproved of by those who are reputedly sublime is a form of witness. But this should not be the principal one. Why? Because others may praise you when they observe one or two good actions, or when you do a few things that please them, but other people cannot fully penetrate the depth of your character. What then is the principal witness? Regard it to be not becoming the object of your own disapproval. You should be able to feel that even if you were to die this evening, you could have done nothing more. For you have striven to the best of your capacity with faith, intelligence, and perseverance, regardless of how weak these may have been. Such is another Tibetan expression, I think. Such that your guts become filled with air and blood and water gushes out of them. Okay. At that point, you have attained a qualified stage of meditative practice. So here's the summary. Therefore, hold the fact of not being the object of your own disapproval as the principal witness. So that's what it's saying here is that we can talk about two types of witness, other people and ourselves. And it's saying here the principal one is you, because other people can't really see your inner intentions and motivations. They can only sort of see your outward behavior and interpret based on that. You can really know what your deepest aspirations and intentions are. So you are the primary witness, principal witness. So let's have a look what Alan Wallace says, and then I want to comment a little bit more on that. Who can be trusted to judge the progress of our spiritual practice? We might appear impressively spiritual to other people, but they are not necessarily the best judges of our progress. The mind training says the best judge of our progress is the chief of the two witnesses. Who are these two? One witness is other people who observe us from outside, but they are limited by their inability to observe what happens in our minds. This requires the second witness, ourselves. We alone can observe our motivation and the quality of our minds from moment to moment. Of the two witnesses, yourself and others, the chief witness is yourself. Rely on yourself honestly to monitor the quality and progress of your practice. This is not simple, because there is no question that we can delude ourselves. So this is why we also consult spiritual friends and teachers. In short, we need to attend to both witnesses, but rely primarily upon the chief witness, ourselves, to monitor and observe the quality and the results of our practice. There is an important distinction to be made here regarding our concern for the opinions of others. Of the eight mundane concerns that Buddhists constantly warn about is reputation, which bears on the opinions of others. If I am worried that the neighbours think that I'm not a good person, this can be a simple fixation on my reputation. Yet Buddhist psychology also refers to concern for the opinions of others as a virtue. This virtue is a type of social conscience that restrains us from doing things we know are wrong, because if others knew of our misdeed, they would think poorly of us. The distinction between the two types of concern for others' opinions hinges on motivation. If you are focused on virtue, doing your best, remedying mistakes and moving on, then you're doing all you can. If other people still think ill of you, that's their problem. You can never be so perfect, compassionate, wise and virtuous that you will be above everyone's criticism. Buddha's cousin slandered him and tried to kill him, and Jesus died at the hands of his enemies. Since we can't control other people's minds, no matter what we do, we are still prone to others' criticism, slander and abuse. However, our happiness need not be contingent on the opinions of others. The chief witness, our primary judge, is ourselves. The chief witness can carefully assess whether criticism is valid or not. If criticism is valid, deal with it. If it is not, forget it. So here, then, again, two witnesses. Principle one is honestly look at ourselves. What is our inner intentions and motivations? But then also, of course, rely on others. Because as we said, we can really delude ourselves, you know, the spiritual ego. And I think if the spiritual egos come in, then others can very clearly see that, particularly other spiritual friends or teachers, that that is something very obvious to others. So then we can rely on others. And if they have this valid criticism, we can take that on board and then improve ourselves. So we can rely on both witnesses, but of course the primary witness is ourselves. Okay. Any question? Let's go to the next one then. This is very important as well. This third point here. Cultivate constantly the joyful mind alone. Before I go to the commentary, we often talk about one of the six perfections is this joyous effort. And then often when people see this joyous effort and they see that we need to put effort in the spiritual practice, they've sort of feel like we have to sort of grit our teeth and force our way through, that somehow then practice becomes a hardship. If that's how we view effort, we've completely missed the point. Because effort or joyous effort in Buddhism is defined as a mind that delights in virtue, a mind that is happy to do good things. So if we've turned our practice into a hardship, we've completely missed the point. So to avoid that, of course, we need to understand what the benefits of the practice are. If we can see that these practices, even if they're difficult, are going to bring us enormous benefit, we're going to happily do them. We saw that in the shamatha part. The antidote to laziness was faith. Faith, seeing the benefits of the practice, then we'll develop aspiration and effort. And that effort is joyful effort. We'll happily do the practice because we'll see it's going to bring us a lot of benefit. So that's in general. Here we're saying that also when we are faced with adverse conditions to have that joyful mind as well. So let's see what the commentary says. This line suggests that having trained your mind and tasted the flavor of true Dharma practice, no matter what adverse conditions befall you, you experience no disturbance within. For you immediately think, I can cultivate its remedy, the two awakening minds. Remaining unassailed in such a manner is also a measure of having trained the mind. Again, regarding the four desirable things and four undesirable things, so these are the eight worldly concerns in the world, when you train the mind by focusing on the four undesirable things, so that is loss, blame, pain, and bad reputation, When you focus on those, everything becomes desirable. You will find thus no narrow mountain terrains or impediments. Thus your mind training will always be filled with joy, and the edifice of your mind training practice will not crumble. This too is a measure of having trained the mind. Again, when you have trained the mind in the dual practice of giving and taking, then whatever suffering afflicts your body and mind, you will instantly have the thought, now what I have taken from others in the past has its consequence, and you will experience once again an extraordinary sense of joy. And here's a summary. In brief, whatever undesirable events occur, if they become factors conducive for training your mind and cause no disquiet, this is a measure of having trained the mind. At that point, your remedy has reached its true depth. So again here, a measure that our mind training practice is going well is that even when we're faced with difficulties in our practice, we can have this joyful mind. We can retain this joyful mind. Because then we can really see these difficult situations as opportunities. Of course, that doesn't mean they're going to be easy, but if we see them as an opportunity to improve ourselves and to practice more, to improve and deepen our wisdom and compassion, then we're going to have a joyful mind, even though it's a difficult situation. Any questions about this point?
When you train the mind on focusing on pain and loss, and everything becomes desirable.
Desirable because it's an opportunity to improve. It's an opportunity, again, like before, the example is when someone's trying to harm us, it's a difficult situation, but it's an opportunity to deepen our patience, our compassion, and so forth, in the similar way here as that. Okay. We're not saying it's not difficult. We're not sort of pretending it's not difficult. That's aversion. That's like denial. So that's not helpful. Of course, it's a difficult, challenging situation, but it's an opportunity. And we even see this in the sort of the business world, you know. Those people in business who are faced with difficult situations, often when they, if they see them as problems or obstacles, they often give up and fail. And it's the people who see difficult situations as opportunities are the ones that usually succeed in business, in life in general.
Mm-hmm. When they say focusing on the four undesirable, are we reflecting on them in meditation? Or?
No, it just means when they arise, if some pain arises in our body or some loss, we lose something, if we can retain that sort of joyful mind and work through the difficulty, that's a measure. If that joyful mind just turns into going, oh no, not that again, go away, then of course we're not taking that, then we're just we're inducing unnecessary suffering. Then we've sort of fallen off from this mind training, particularly in being able to take adverse conditions into the path. Of course, what we need to appreciate is that now we have often very strong aversion to these difficult situations, particularly the ones that are very difficult, and not to think that overnight somehow that's going to change. You know, what we'll find is that small difficulties in our life, we'll be able to retain that sort of attitude, here's an opportunity for me. You know, if someone starts to irritate us a little bit, we can go, oh, here's a good opportunity to practice my patience and compassion. But of course, if someone is saying something very critical of us, like shouting at us, it probably is a bit unrealistic to expect that we can take now at our level to remain, to keep that joyful mind. Mm-hmm. But of course, if we can retain the joyful mind when someone irritates us a little bit, then more, eventually, then someone could be yelling abuse at us and we can maintain that state of mind and really instantly have compassion for them and do whatever we can to help them. That's a measure. And personally, I find in this area, when we're faced with difficult situations, particularly people, what is very helpful, I have found in my experience, is don't do cognitive fusion. you do cognitive fusion, I think you've got no chance. If you see this person as a nasty person, a bad person, you're not going to be able to do this. It's not going to happen. If we can really avoid the cognitive fusion, if we can really just, in the correct way, see there is a person engaging in very harmful behaviour, we've got a chance to keep this joyful mind and think, wow, here's an opportunity for me to help that person who's really behaving very badly, creating a lot of suffering. And so that, I find, is the as one measure, is if someone is behaving badly toward others or even toward ourselves, what is the, and this is a little bit related to the next point, what is our instinct? Are we sort of doing this, or are we thinking, you know, we're having empathy and compassion? What's sort of starting to come up? If we see that that person is doing a lot of harm, and we're seeing that somehow we have empathy and we're starting to have compassion and seeing that they're just creating so much suffering for themselves and others, that's a measure. Because then the self-cherishing, because self-cherishing doesn't want that, to see that. So that's a measure. So then let's look at the last point. If this can be done even when distracted, you are trained. Just as a skillful horseman does not fall when distracted by the horse suddenly rearing up, in the same way, once your mind is trained, then even when unexpected adversities arise, such as unanticipated criticism and denigration, you instantly cope by applying appropriate antidotes. In this way, if adversities become factors conducive to the awakening mind, and if you do not fall prey to the adverse conditions, your mind is trained. So here is a sort of follow on from the last point, is of course at our level, if we are expecting maybe some difficult situation to come our way, then we're a bit prepared and we can maybe try to see the situation in a good way and keep a joyful mind. But sometimes something unexpected comes, you know, someone criticizes us out of nowhere. Then if we can still retain the joyful mind, this is a good measure that our practice is really going well. So just to finish off this section then, furthermore, cultivate the thought, the time of death is uncertain, and were it to come suddenly, I have no means of facing it other than this practice. This is true Dharma. Wonderful indeed is my path. In this manner, make sure you fortify your mind so no matter when you die, you will do so joyfully and with a palpable warmth within. If you possess these signs of being trained, illnesses and harms caused by possessors will enhance your realizations. This doesn't mean that you need not train your mind further. This merely presents the measure of when the application of that remedy attains the measure of completeness. So even though this is a measure, these points are a measure that our mind training is going well, of course we don't need to be complacent, we need to continue to practice more. So just to summarise this, and then maybe if there's any last questions, again I'll read from this book here, it's on page 164. Remembering these slogans from time to time will help us gauge our progress in mind training. If we are giving too much credence to other people's opinions, for example, we invoke the slogan, "Of the two judges, rely on the principal one," and remind ourselves to make an honest assessment of ourselves. These slogans will help us to see what we need to correct and direct our our Lojong practice. It's important to practice mind training without thinking of other people as the recipients. Even though many of the benefits of Lojong practice may not at first be visible or tangible, we should have confidence that everything we do leaves an impression in our mental continuum and will continue to exert an influence. Lojong practice will definitely leave positive imprints in our unconscious and will continue to receive benefits without necessarily realizing it. The goal of all Buddhist practice is to transcend our egoistic obsession and dispel ignorance. Okay. Any questions about this section, about how to measure whether or not our practice is going in the right direction?
Can you repeat in a few words how to really know if I'm progressing or not?
So, again, the first one is what we are doing reducing self-cherishing, self-grasping, or not? And, of course, one way to check that is, particularly the self-cherishing, is are we having more a second and third person perspective when we encounter others? Or are we still simply viewing them from the perspective of how is that person affecting me? Rather than thinking, what is that? What's going on with that person? You know, what's their perspective? How can I help them? So again, the more we find ourselves in the shoes of others when we encounter them and trying to understand their perspective, that's a sign. Whereas if we're always simply looking at every situation, how is this situation merely affecting me, only me, then that's not a healthy sign. It should be, we should be having a more holistic perspective, a broader perspective in seeing the situation of not only how is this situation affecting me, but how is this situation affecting this person, or even how is this situation affecting also others as well. If we're having this sort of perspective, this is a very good sign. And then again, to really monitor ourselves honestly, the principal witness, monitor really what is our underlying motivation, you know? Not so much what the outward appearance is, but what is the motivation? Check. And then, of course, from time to time, also rely on others, particularly qualified teachers, but also any spiritual friends who are also trying to follow this sort of path. Rely on their advice, because sometimes the last person to see that we've got a problem is ourselves. Sometimes when we've got some negative behavior or attitude, often it's very obvious to the people around us and it's not so obvious to us. So don't ignore criticisms from others, particularly people who we have trust in and who are really trying to help us. Take their advice. If they say something, then listen to that, and if it's a valid criticism, take it on board and work with it. Don't react to it. So this is the second point. And then, of course, the third and fourth point is really about our balanced mind. You know, when we're faced with difficulties, what happens? Do we react to difficult situations, or are we seeing them as opportunities for improving and growing as a person? The more that we can see difficult situations as opportunities instead of problems or obstacles, that's a good sign as well. Because that's, remember, the enemy and friend shifting. So again, if we start to really see difficult situations in our life as opportunities and keep a sort of a joyful mind and not immediately just have aversion and react in a negative way, that's the other sign. So they're the signs, I think, those points.
Please, do you mind repeating the four Buddhist alliances?
It's not to rely on the person, but on their teaching. But not to rely on the teacher, but the teaching. Not to rely on the words, but the meaning. The third one, which I didn't include actually, was not to rely on the interpretive meaning, but the definitive meaning. Because sometimes the words have a deeper meaning. So not to rely on the teacher, but the teaching. Or not merely the teacher, the teaching. To not merely rely on the words, but the meaning. To not merely rely on the interpreted meaning, but the definitive meaning, the underlying meaning. And then to not rely simply on intellectual understanding, but on direct experience.
Thank you.
called the Four Alliances. Any other questions?
What was the fourth one?
To not merely rely on intellectual understanding, but direct experience.
How to increase aspiration? Like, it can be different levels of aspiration. So.
For a practice, you mean, or for...
For practice, for anything.
Well, of course, we go back to the preliminaries, don't we? That's what they're for. That often we lose aspiration in practice because we're caught up in this stuff out here. You know, oh, I'd like to meditate today, but I don't have time. I'm too busy, for example. Or, oh, this practice is too difficult. I'm not going to do it. We haven't appreciated the benefits. So again, the main one, of course, is to work on the preliminaries to understand genuine happiness is not to be found anywhere out there. It's inside. If we can make that shift, and this is the first two preliminaries, all the preliminary practice, those four thoughts. If we can work on those, we can turn the mind inwards. So that's going to be, we won't be lazy, and we won't be wasting time on meaningless stuff. So that's the basis. And then on top of that, for a particular practice, if we can really understand what the practice is and the benefit that it's going to bring us and how it fits in the bigger picture, then we're going to have a lot of aspiration to do it because we'll see that it's going to bring us enormous benefit.
But if we see benefits on intellectually, like, do we need to meditate so to feel them?
Of course, if the more we internalize the benefits, yes, that can help. Of course, that can help. Yes. So we can do a little meditation, sitting quietly, reflecting on the benefits, and that can probably have much more of an impact on us. So yes, that can be helpful. That can help.
So if endeavors are raising our self-grasping, then it's not good. But can we know before engaging with a new project, job-wise or something, if this is meant to raise the self-grasping or topping? Can we...
Remember, not all practices are directly targeting self-grasping. So remember here it says, I think it generally says, directly or indirectly. So we're doing a lot of practices that are supporting the other practices which are then directly. For example, what's directly targeting self-grasping is the Vipassana practice. But as a basis for that, we need to be ethical. But generally, being ethical is not targeting self-grasping. It may be targeting a bit of self-cherishing and negative behavior, but ethical behavior is not directly targeting self-grasping. It's only targeting negative behavior, but that's necessary as a basis for the shamatha and vipassana practice. And even shamatha is not really directly targeting self-grasping, because making the mind calm and clear, which will help less mental afflictions come up. But what's directly targeting, of course, is the Vipassana practice. So here in this one, I think if self-cherishing is increasing, then there's a problem.
So if somebody goes like, yeah, I did it well, after doing it, then it was not good doing it.
No, but again, we need to praise our behavior, not the person.
I did it well.
Praise what we did.
Oh, for example, an artist is saying, this piece of art, even if he has done it, is well done, then it's okay?
Well, it depends on the motivation, of course. I'm talking about virtuous behavior. If they made the painting just to boost the ego, no. But if they did a painting to inspire others for a good reason, then we can be happy about doing that because that's helping to inspire others. So again, it depends on the action, the motivation and the action. Any virtuous behavior we do, it's good to acknowledge that and praise the behavior. If you praise yourself, of course, it's self-cherishing, ego trip. But if you praise the behavior, it'll encourage you to engage in more and more virtuous behavior. So that's, of course, cherishing others, because that virtuous behavior is benefiting others.
So you could praise your own virtuous behavior. It's really
you should.
And
We must. Because it encourages us to engage in it more and more and more. Because again, in our modern society, we have so much focus on the negative. So when we do a good thing, praise the behavior and make a strong determination to continue to do that good behavior for the benefit of others.
But there seems to be such a thin line.
Again, it's the way we think and speak. Avoid the cognitive fusion.
It's not that thing.
So, no, you can say, that behavior was wonderful. I'm going to continue to engage in that behavior again and again and again. But if you go, I, then that's praising yourself. So avoid the cognitive fusion. Don't praise yourself. Praise the behavior. Rejoice in your behavior. Don't rejoice in yourself. Rejoice in your behavior and make a resolve to continue to engage in that behavior for the benefit of others. Mm-hmm.